Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shaped me, published by Headline and out now. It's been described as a mashup between a Nancy Mitford novel and Fleabag. It's a book for women and those who love them, and it's about women and how our relationships with each other make our lives brilliant and sometimes impossible. I'm the eldest of six girls, and my sisters are the only women I would kill for and the only women I've ever wanted to kill. The Sisterhood is available from bookshops nationwide. If you want to support the podcast, buying it is the very best way for you to do that. This week, I've been reading Mary Wellesley's piece in the LRB about anchoresses, the women who chose a life of seclusion and religious contemplation around the 11th and 12th centuries. Anchoresses were supposed to be in a state of constant contemplation, often confined within a single room. They were allowed to give advice to visitors who sought their instruction when they weren't meditating for days at a time or sleeping standing up. It sounds like a tough life, but I can't be the only person thinking that if they'd had Kindles in the 11th century, it might have been quite appealing. Mary Wellesley's piece, in which she reviews Hermits and Anchorites in England, edited by E.A. Jones, is in the 23rd of May issue of the LRB, and it's fascinating reading for historians and aspiring recluses. By way of contrast, this week's guest is an advocate for living out loud. Gina Dawson is an award-winning, best-selling YA author and activist. She's the school's role model for Stonewall, and she's written a brilliant book for adults, The Gender Games, a memoir with a powerful discussion about gender that charts her experience as a trans woman. She might be the first guest we've interviewed who's written a banned book. This Book Is Gay was banned from public libraries in a town in Alaska. Her 16th book, Meat Market, is about Yana, a reluctant teen supermodel who discovers that getting everything you think you want can make you feel very lonely. It's smart, funny, pacey, and you care about every character. I tore through it. We hung out with Gino in Hove with her adorable puppy Prince. She made delicious banana bread, and we talked about Armistead Maupin, Mallory Blackman, what it's like to teach books to kids, and the giddy thrill of getting very, very scared. You might have the most organised. Can I describe the seat?
Please do, yeah.
Is this your sitting room and study?
So this is, yeah, so I've only, it's like a little one bed flat. So this is like lounge and office area. And then round the back, there's bathroom, kitchen and bedroom.
I love your office. I love your fabulous light up freak show sign. Are those bulbs functional?
And they do function, yes, except for one, which has never functioned, which is annoying.
Oh, and also, I'm excited to see your aerial, because, do you remember, I think the last time I saw you properly, to do a bit of a, you know, wanky, like, oh, we see each other in real life, it was at a bar on Halloween in Brighton, and it was a Disney drag night, I think, for Halloween.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I have no memory of this.
And it was like after the Armistead Maupin.
Oh, yes. I know exactly, yes, above Broadway,
yeah.
Yes.
And lots of, I think, you know...
And yes.
Teenagers singing Let It Go, mostly, let's be real. But I think there are a few aerials.
Yes. That is a very off-brand aerial, though. That is not a Disney-endorsed aerial.
Do you like the unofficial ones?
Oh, yeah, that was a knock-off gift from somebody for a joke. But Little Mermaid, although very problematic, is probably my Disney favourite. And I did want to be Ariel when I was a kid. So, yeah, so we start, shall I talk you through the top shelf first?
So the top shelf,
this is all my foreign translations. Oh. So this is kind of, I call it my ego shelf. And they kind of have to go somewhere, even though obviously I cannot read really any of them.
Do you have a favourite of your foreign covers? Or...
The Japanese one here is wondrous.
Wow. That is so, what is that? I can't tell.
This book is gay, although you would never be able to tell, which is great.
I'm just going to describe the cover.
Please
for,
do.
Oral reasons. So it's, I guess, white with a kind of neon orange. You get lots of Japanese characters, and I see a phone, a plane, a postcard, a stop sign. So the illustrations are really cute. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd buy that in Hema or...
Cruel Summer has done very well in Polish. That did really, really well. And what I love about that one is Cruel Summer is very much the poor relation of my novels. It never sold anywhere else. There is only one foreign edition. It is the Polish one. And yeah, well, and then it went on to do really, really well. So not all of my books have been translated into foreign languages. All of the above.
So are you like a superstar in Poland? Is it like when the Ramones went
like
to Mexico?
Beatles. Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think in terms of when I look at my royalty checks, I mean, the one that makes me money is This Book Is Gay in North America, which has done really, really well and has been challenged and banned and unchallenged since it came out in 2014. So that's the one, I think, when I die, it might well be This Book Is Gay that goes on my gravestone, and that's fine.
How does it feel to have your book banned? Did you have some idea that it would be sold in some very, very conservative territories, and that?
Well, I just thought you wouldn't sell in those, and it's, and I think authors would be fibbing if they said they weren't trying to crack the North American market, because it's such an enormous market. You can make an awful lot of money, and particularly with like Say Her Name and with Margot and Me, I did sort of intend to, I thought, right, this book will play well in North America because it's quite an American version of what England is like. And of course, the only one of my books which has got a North American deal was This Book Is Gay, which is the super explicit guide for LGBTQ people. And so there's no way of gauging what it is foreign publishers are going to want. And when we found out that Sarah Palin's district had banned This Book Is Gay, it was a delight, because obviously free publicity. And initially we were quite jubilant about it as it was picked up by the national press in America. But then when that had blown over, I was just kind of sad, because of course, if you were a young LGBTQ person living in Wallsilla, Alaska, you were being told by your district that there was something weird about you. And so actually from then on, when This Book Is Gay has been challenged in places, because it was challenged in Brazil as well, it just makes me sad. It makes me sad for the kids who are seeing that their lives are being called into question. It's a bummer.
I mean, I suppose if there's publicity around, they know someone out there has their back and is there for them and wants them to have the information.
And but... this is true. Yeah, maybe it's helped the book find the hands that have needed it. So maybe it's not all bad. This Book Is Gay came about because they weren't sure whether to put it in adult books or in children's books. And then they came up with the zany notion of having a non-fiction teen section. And I think what has worked really well for This Book Is Gay was, and Mind Your Head as well, was the rise of the YouTubers. Because there wasn't an obvious place in Waterstones or your local bookshop for teenage non-fiction. But then when every YouTuber started doing their guide to life, then Mind Your Head and This Book Is Gay had a place to hang out.
A place to live. So I'm going down onto the next shelf.
Into the A's and B's.
There's an amazing range here. I love that you have flowers in the attic.
Of course. I read that much, much too young.
Is there any other time?
You have to read Flowers in the Attic when you're a teenager. It's YA. I will stand by that. I really think that Flowers in the Attic is YA fiction from a time when there wasn't YA fiction.
I absolutely agree, because the way the characters are written and the focus on their emotional journey and their feelings, that absolutely is for teenagers.
Yeah. And it's not the only YA novel to deal with incest as well. I think Forbidden by Tabitha Suzuma picked up on it many, many years later in quite a similar plot.
Oh, I don't know that book.
It was a bigger success in America. I don't think it quite played out over here. And I'm not sure what happened to Suzuma's career past about 2010. But yeah, she wrote a very controversial novel called Forbidden that was that dealt with incest.
I see you've got loads of Mallory Blackman.
Yes, yeah, probably my favourite. I started writing because of Noughts and Crosses. I was a primary school teacher and I was teaching year six. And I went into Borders, God rest its soul, and said, right, I want a new class reader. And I think we'd finished Golden Compass, which is on the other side. And the bookseller pointed me in the direction of Noughts and Crosses. And I'd heard of Mallory through Pig Heart Boy. And they said, but OK, this is like Pig Heart Boy, but a bit older. And I really, really distinctly remember reading all of Noughts and Crosses on a train to Newcastle to see my old university friend. And by the end of it, by the time we reached York, I was sobbing, like openly sobbing on the train. And a woman had to ask if I was all right. And I was like, no, I'm actually not, because I don't want to spoil Noughts and Crosses because it's about to be a big BBC TV show as well. But it's harrowing.
It's taken that long for that to reach the screen, you know, because it was such a...
Yeah.
Well, it is such a big book, but, you know, when it was published, such a powerful book.
Well, the option has been back and forth three times because I know Mallory now. And that's wild when you meet your author heroes and then become friends with them. She had the rights, then they reverted back to her, then sold the rights again. And I think, and I was talking about this yesterday because, like, weirdly, I was at Mammoth Pictures, who are producing Noughts and Crosses. I was there yesterday to talk about a different project. And we were talking about how sometimes it's to do with the time. And obviously, next to Mallory, we've got Margaret Atwood. And I think there was a version of Handmaid's Tale made in the 80s as well. And it was very bad. And it's not really talked about now. I don't think it's really gone down as a classic. And I think we are living in slightly dystopian times. And so I wonder if now is absolutely the right time for Noughts and Crosses. Maybe we needed those riots in North America. Maybe we needed Black Lives Matter for Noughts and Crosses to make sense in a way that I think we needed Trump's presidency for Handmaid's Tale to make sense as a TV show as well. So yes, in theory, Noughts and Crosses should have been a film about 10 years ago. But I do wonder if actually now is the time.
I really love that idea that as a writer, you can write something that only ever becomes more relevant. I don't love the idea that we live in an actual dystopia. No. But there we are. What can you do? I think it's really interesting as well that that is a book that you came to and loved. You know, and it's, I think it's, is it sort of sold as YA? Is it, you know, written?
Noughts and Crosses?
Yeah.
Yes, I think the TV show is, they're going for a big crossover market. I think it's like a big flagship show for them. But certainly when the book came out, Mallory, in fact, I believe Mallory has only written novels for young people.
But that you fell in love with her as an adult reading for young adults. I think it's so interesting and it just shows how important it is to be kind of open-minded. And I'm guessing you've got lots of, you know, adult fans. Well, me. Hello, I'm 34 and I love your books. But I wonder whether it's because it's a world that's sort of very immediate and very emotional and very real, I guess, even though obviously that is about, you know, a future that's almost the opposite to what we know.
I think what's smart, and I think the reason, this is the third copy of Noughts and Crosses I've owned because I do keep giving it away, is that for me it really exemplifies young adult fiction and what young adult fiction can do. It's immediate, it's a page turner in a way that, and I don't like when page turner is used as somehow a negative thing, like it's a book you really can't put down. But what I love about Noughts and Crosses is that it completely defies genre. You know, is it a science fiction book? Is it dystopia? Is it a political allegory? Is it a romance? It's a Romeo and Juliet story. It picks up on issues about terrorism and warfare. So it does a lot of things, and that's why people often, in quite a disparaging way, say, you know, will you write a grown-up book? And I'm like, well, no, because I quite like that as a YA author. You know, I've been able to write horror and romance, non-fiction. So, you know, I've been able to dip my toes in lots of different genres while all coming under that big umbrella of YA. Whereas if I was going to write adult fiction, I guess I would kind of have to pick a team.
Yeah.
Would I write crime fiction? Would I write literary fiction? You know, it's difficult to know what I would do. So I quite like that YA has let me manoeuvre.
I guess it comes back to what you were saying about, you know, having a book, but well, there's, where do we put this in the shop? There's no shelf for this. Yeah. And it's a building your own shelf time. Mm-hmm. What's that book over there?
Oh, we've got Wuthering Heights. Good old Wuthering Heights, which that was... Yeah, I had to come back to that recently because I did Kate Moss's anthology, I Am Heathcliff.
Oh.
So I'd read I'd attempted to read Wuthering Heights, like all teenagers do, especially teenagers from Yorkshire. I'd attempted to read it as a teenager, thought it was boring. Attempted to read it in my 20s, wasn't in love with it. And then finally reading it in my 30s, it all finally clicked. And I realised I sort of stopped trying to make it be something that it's not. Like, I think I wanted it to be a really scary ghost story. And it's not a really scary ghost story. It's kind of, it's a story about a very toxic relationship. And maybe I had to be in toxic relationships to really understand.
In your own.
Yeah.
Dystopia.
Yeah. And as well, you know, it's about, I love that, you know, it's it was strange. I think you could read Wuthering Heights alongside Where Is She? Gone Girl as a book about how just love, some people deserve each other, because that's the message I took from both of those novels.
I love that. I'd never ever thought of that comparison before, and it's making me want to do a whole other podcast about those books. So when you were a teenager, what were those books that first really made you fall in love with reading and blew your mind a bit?
I've not got a lot of them here. Actually, that's a lie, because there's some right there. I know it's probably an enormous cliche for a child of the 80s to come back to Roald Dahl, but when I was in 5C, but they, you know, Roald Dahl, there's a copy of The Witches there as well. They were really what made me a reader. And I was a very, very young reader. I came to books super young with Mr. Men and things like that, but then very quickly graduated onto Roald Dahl. Notably, I remember staying up very, very late to read George's Marvelous Medicine. I couldn't believe, you know, that this is a book about a boy who poisons his grandma. I mean, David Walliams couldn't dream of doing that. He just wouldn't be allowed. They're so dark and so funny. And then as I got a bit older and I moved on to his sort of meaty ones like The Witches and Matilda, which have got a bit more clout to them and are a bit more sort of chapter books. And by the time I'd exhausted Roald Dahl's back catalogue, I suppose I was broadly what I would deem as a young adult, sort of like 10 or 11, 12 years old. And I moved straight into point horrors, Nancy Drew and Doctor Who fiction. And to be honest, that those three things on a cycle pretty much got me through my whole teenage years, until when I was about maybe 15, I jumped ship from point horror to Stephen King and Dean Koontz. And there's definitely a copy of Pet Sematary down there somewhere in the K's.
It sounds so mad now, but I remember being, I think, maybe 10, and there was like one point horror on there was a classroom bookshelf, and I think it got there by accident, and there was a real fight over who was going to get it. But because it was so slick and American and alien, it just seemed like the most glamorous thing. And I'm so sad that I've, you know, wanted to revisit them, and they've not always stood up. They might for some people.
We did a blog, before the podcast there was a blog, and we did the Point Horror Book Club on my website. Some of them have aged quite well, and oddly, it wasn't necessarily the ones I loved as a teenager. There must be, over in the S for Smith section, yeah, I can see it now, there's the Forbidden Game trilogy, which were originally published by Point Horror, and they are still brilliant. And L.J. Smith, of course, went on to do The Vampire Diaries, and that's what she became more known for. But I think pre-Vampire Diaries, she did this a trilogy for Point Horror called The Forbidden Game. And it's almost pre-Twilight. It's a lot of the same themes that are in Twilight.
Oh, I do. I've just spied some a lot of lovely Angela Carter.
Yes, possibly my favourite writer, possibly.
We have The Bloody Chamber, you have Nuts at the Circus, mm-hmm. and The Passion of New Eve. So the classics. When did you first meet her?
I would have just moved to Brighton, and my friend Kerry, and I think so often that's the way books spread, isn't it? Through friends and word of mouth. I think just before I moved to Brighton, she got me onto Armistead Maupin, who we come to on the next shelf down, and said she sent me a copy of Tales of the City with a post-it note stuck to the front saying, they say Brighton is the San Francisco of the UK. And it's so odd. I mean, it's so strange how my life has kind of followed. You know, I guess I came to Brighton as a Marianne Singleton. Then for a while I was a Mouse Tolliver, and then very much now an Anna Madrigal. But not long after Tales of the City, Kerry also said, have you read any Angela Carter? And she started me off with Nights at the Circus and then Wise Children, which I don't think I've got a copy of. I think I gave it to an ex. Didn't get that back, did I?
Shout out to the ex.
Yes,
shout out to put it in the post.
Thank you. Please return my copy of Wise Children. And Nights at the Circus is still my favourite Angela Carter book. I just don't think anybody writes better than her. We're having, I think it'd be safe to say, a big Angela Carter revival at the moment. And I think there are a lot of pretenders who are, whether they know they're doing it or not, and it's really difficult when you've grown up who feel slightly in the vein of Angela Carter. But I don't think we're ever going to get that. It all felt very natural. Yes, it was quite posed at times, and you know, it was very, there was a very, you can hear my dog snoring, and very sort of, yeah, there was a definite dialect to it, but it was kind of, it never felt forced with Angela Carter. The poetry was whimsical, yes, but never quirky for the sake of being quirky. And that's, I must admit, that's a big turn off for me, is that quite kind of languid Sofia Coppola style novels, yeah. Kind of, yeah, not naming it. I'm not going to name any names.
You know, the comedy world that, like, oh, I'm wacky and I've got a bin for a hat. So no. But I do think it's really, really tough because most writers, I think, are readers, and finding your own voice when your head is full of so many beautiful voices
is a challenge. I tend not to read YA when I'm writing YA. I mean, we were just saying before we started that, in my writey bits, I tend to read at the moment. I just cannot get enough of kind of, I'm reluctant to call it women's crime, but very often it's sort of that domestic crime written by female authors. Huge fan of Erin Kelly. And what's really wonderful is I read...
Upcoming guest.
Is she really? Oh, hello, Erin. I can't wait for her new one. I started with He Said, She Said, and then realised there was a backlist to enjoy. And that's one of my favourite things, when you discover that there is more,
like
more like it.
Yeah.
Better. And that's what I did with Gillian Flynn as well. Gone Girl, like for a lot of people, Gone Girl was my introduction to Gillian Flynn. And then when I found out I could also get my hands on Sharp Objects and Dark Places, I was really excited about that too.
I still can't quite in my head, you know, she's still Gillian. I know she's Gillian, but
she is, yeah.
It's very hard to make that shift. Gone Girl. Did you know anything about that book when you read it? Did the twist take you aback?
I sort of half figured it out. And I think it's one of those, and Gone Girl maybe more than most, suffered from that you'll never see the twist coming thing, which has been basically, you know, that is every book that has been released. Although I think I sense that the publishing industry is slightly tiring of the type of book that has followed Gone Girl out, where the whole thing, the whole marketing plan is you'll never see the twist. Because, I mean, that it's led to some really audacious twists, including some which are nonsense.
It's personal entirely, but I'd much rather know what's happening because I want to know sort of how it happens more than have that...
That's what I tried to do with Cruel Summer. I think with Cruel Summer, which was my second novel, like way back in 2013, there's only 7 characters in the book, and you know that one of them has done it. So it's not a whodunit, it's a why done it. And yeah, I'm a fan of a why done it. Like, you know who's done it, but why? Interesting.
It's a strong genre. I think I get another business idea. Dana Go. Oh, no, I can't even. I love that book. I was sold that by a bookseller in Blackwells in Oxford in a sort of like, just, you know, I'd just done an event there and I said, you can sell me anything. What shall I read that I might not read otherwise? And I thought it was really charming.
Yeah, I've just worked with Simon on the Proud anthology as well, and he is just the sweetest man in the world. I thought it was brilliant. YA, and I say this full of love for YA, it's my job and it's become my life. Sometimes, you know, it can take itself very, very seriously. And No, I Can't Even is just fun, just super fun. And there's another one there, Lobsters by Tom and Lucy, by Lucy Iverson and Tom Ellen, is another YA, which is sort of from that in-betweeners school, a very British, quite naughty, knowing sense of humour that I don't think America does very well.
We're not relevant, but odd. I was in an Edinburgh Fringe play with Tom Ellen, possibly the worst play that's ever been written or made. I don't know if I can get sued for this.
Is it the same Tom Ellen?
Yeah.
No, that's such a small world.
Because I checked, because I got the press release, and I was like, because I knew the PR a little bit, like, really weird question for Tom, but I don't suppose, because I'm really rubbish at Facebook and we sort of lost touch a bit. But
well, he's very offline as well.
Yeah, he's very offline. I think he's in Paris now. But there are rumours of a DVD of this play. And I think we both sort of say, one day we'll meet up and watch it, but I don't think anyone can quite face it.
Do it. So yeah, love that. Yeah, and yeah, more funny YA.
A bit of Louise Renison, who yes. I love so much.
Oh yeah, and much missed as well. Really those missed. Books meant an awful lot to an awful lot of girls.
We know we're only about three shelves down as well. There's so much here. I see the Armistead Maupin. I really, really love these editions because I think
they're the best ones they've ever done.
I love these covers. I'm going to grab, let's go for Baby Cakes in the middle.
So are they all that? Because do you know what? Those have been lent and swapped. So now actually, so in my possession, apparently, I've only got more Tales of the City, Significant Others and Baby Cakes.
So you're missing Tales and Further Tales.
Tales, Further Tales and sure the Show Review. Which at one point I have had, so I don't know where they've gone. Again, probably the same ex.
Do you have a favourite? Is that an impossible question?
So let me get this right. So Tales of the City is when Marianne moves. Further Tales of the City is the one with the transubstantiation in the church.
I think so, in Grace Cathedral.
Yes.
And that guy who's the reporter.
Yeah.
Then
third one is the cult when Jim Jones turns up in
with,
San Francisco.
With Mona. Yes. And is that Gigi? The one when they're in Britain and Mona marries that guy? Is it Mona? No.
Not Mona. Mona's the model.
Yes, but she's
yeah,
the
no,
one
right.
who
yeah.
goes off to the stately home.
Yes, I think that's four or five.
And it's Michael Tolliver in London in the yes. little flat in Notting Hill.
Significant Others. A Holiday in the Redwoods. No, so that's the holiday one.
What's the holiday one?
So this is one where they're at like a country retreat. A Holiday in the Redwood goes uproariously awry when the opposing sexes camp out rather too close to each other for comfort. Among these entangled in the mayhem are Dee Dee, reformed...
That's not the kind of... Not quite Camp David, but it's when all the guys go off and there's like the empowerment camp.
Yes, that's right. Yep, that's the one. And then Show Review is where Marianne goes full dark Marianne and she kind of goes...
gets her glamorous job.
Yeah, and abandons her family, yeah.
And the Shauna is on the scene then.
That's right, yes. Shauna's the daughter, isn't... Yes, yeah. Little baby Shauna. And then
Connie's
on the other side are the newer ones. So there's Michael Tolliver Lives and Marianne in the Autumn and Mary... The Last Days of Anna Madrigal.
Yeah. I was reading that and just... You know when you're crying and you don't even know it? And I think producer Dale came in and found me and thought there had been a death. Like, yeah, well. No spoilers. Mm.
But and the new series is coming to Netflix in June. It's like, I cannot wait. Because it feels right. And when you look at the casting as well, like Ellen Page as Shauna feels really right, and Laura Linney and Olympia Dukakis. And normally I would not be championing a cisgender woman playing a trans character, but obviously Olympia has played Anna Madrigal throughout and was amazing. Yeah, and so I think I would have been sadder to lose Olympia than I would to gain a trans actress, but amazing we have anyway, because apparently the new series will flash back to Anna Madrigal's younger life where she will be played by a trans actress. And if you've never read a Tales of the City book, treat yourself. Just start with Tales of the City. There's nothing else quite like them.
I'm quite jealous of people who've got
discover it for the first time.
I reread those quite often, but you said you're not much of a rereader.
Not much, but Tales of the City is one that I absolutely have. I think I've read the first one certainly three times with Beecham and Marianne's slightly doomed relationship with Beecham. But just, it's heartbreaking, and Anna Madrigal's relationship in that first one is so good as well. Although I realise in this moment I have given away the twist. But then now having a trans character wouldn't be a twist now. Mm. So, it's very much a sign of its time that there's like a big reveal kind of that what? One of the characters is trans kind of. If there is such a thing as a queer community, it's partly because of the way his books have brought people together, I guess. And I wonder if those books have cemented a community and made a community, because there certainly isn't one in real life. So
when I saw him and I saw you at the Lit Salon talking, and it was properly like, I don't know, being a teenager and maybe seeing Beyonce or Gaga, so just seeing him on stage, and I was like crying, what were you doing? I can't tell you, I can't explain this. But I think I found those, but when I was a very, very lonely teenager, and knowing I didn't need them like other people needed them, and yet they reached me at a time when I needed to be reached.
I mean, it's a lost. It's they're all orphans, and I think the notion of the family you make is a trope that's been. I've done it with all of the above, or with lots of my books. You know, whether you identified more with Marianne or with Dee Dee or with Michael. You know, these were all kind of orphans in a way, and people who made that family on Barbary Lane.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
We'll be back to Gino soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. A book so valuable that if it were a currency, it would be the only thing holding its value against the euro. This week, it's A Small Person Far Away, also published as Bombs on Aunt Dainty, by Judith Kerr, published by HarperCollins. This is an autobiographical novel based on Kerr's own experiences of living as a Jewish teenage refugee in London during the Blitz. It's one of my favourite books of all time. It makes you realise how many of the things we experience as vulnerable, living humans are completely universal, and Kerr's astonishing honesty in the way she portrays a family who love each other intensely, but sometimes feel as though they're tearing each other apart is deeply moving and often very funny. I love this book so much, and I'm sure that you will too. That's A Small Person Far Away by Judith Kerr, who died on May the 23rd at the age of 95, and will be missed enormously. Now, back to Juno.
I see Stephen King.
It was a big... It's a funny one because, again, I read a lot of Dean Koontz and Stephen King when I was a teenager. Often more Dean Koontz than Stephen King because Dean Koontz had a lot more female protagonists.
Oh, interesting. I don't know Dean Koontz at all.
So no, very, very similar to Stephen King. Quite pulpy horror epics. Often, you know, I don't know if they were passing the Bechdel test. You know, these women were very often in peril or being terrorised by some ghost or serial killer. But Stephen King, I don't know if he would be the first to admit or not, but his women characters are not the best. They're often sexy mums. Yeah, she's had 2 kids, but she's still really sexy. And I didn't massively pick up on that when I was reading them as a teenager. But weirdly... Again, while I was writing somewhere, I thought, oh gosh, I need something to read. Let's read some Stephen King and some Dean Koontz. And yeah, it became clear that Dean Koontz's women characters did have a lot more agency than Stephen King's. But then Stephen King's are scarier than Dean Koontz's. So it's kind of, which would you rather?
I want to read Dean Koontz now, although I'm not wild about being scared. But I was just thinking about Misery and what that book would be if there was a gender flip. And I can't work out whether... Because it's a woman obsessed with a man, if we're supposed to think she's sort of somehow more pathetic and more of a loser, where she'd be more immediately menacing, or he'd be more immediately menacing if it was, you know, the other way around.
I think it's a bit, I was once told, you know, journalism works by way of, you know, sort of dog bites man isn't very interesting, man bites dog is a front page. And so I think the sad thing is men... enact violence on women so often that it almost sort of wouldn't work in Misery because it's just, oh yeah, it's a domestic violence story. It's about a man beating a woman. It's become, you know, this is very familiar. But having a woman, particularly a little nerdy woman, trap a man in a house and break his legs and force him to write a novel, that's a bit more like Man Bites Dog. That's more unusual and more strange. But interesting how quickly even Kathy Bates, his really terrifying and Oscar-winning portrayal in that film, was played for laughs. And very quickly, that character has almost become a bit of a joke.
But that's exactly it.
The joke is, wasn't it, which didn't help.
To be fair.
Yeah.
Which was very funny. Yeah. But the joke being like, you know, well, if she was an attractive woman, it would be fine. But because it's this sort of, you know, frumpy, dowdy woman, you're like, oh, God, I can't imagine anything worse. Whereas...
Oh, the hand that rocks the cradle. Mm. Psychos can be very sexy as well. Single white female. Oh, I love a 90s
fatal
thriller.
Fatal Attraction.
Fatal Attraction, yeah. Oh, I want to watch some 90s thrillers now.
Do you like being scared?
Especially in books. Do you suspend your disbelief and just let yourself get spooked? Or is a bit of you out of the book going, it's not real?
It's definitely, definitely harder for a book to get under your skin than it is for a film, where they are so reliant on sound effects and misdirection of drawing your attention into different places. And when I was starting out writing Say Her Name, I read a thing about the way we process information is we're actually, even without knowing it, reading ahead a little bit. So we've slightly processed the scare before we get to the scare. So like a cat jumping out of a kitchen cupboard just isn't going to work in fiction. The trick with Say Her Name was to how can I create something which is going to stay with you after you've put the book away. And it's obviously the Joey Tribbiani putting The Shining in the freezer to stop it being scary. Something that's not even going to work. And I think my favourite scary book, and I'm assuming it's on the other side, is a book called Dark Matter by Michelle Paver. We're going over to the other bookshelf. So it should be under the P for paper section. So there it is, yeah. And Dark Matter is the scariest book I've ever read.
The thing is, from the spine, so I should say as well, I think I might have put my contact lens in the wrong eyes.
Oh, no.
You know, all day I've been like, this isn't quite right. So I'm just like, this doesn't look particularly scary, sort of waving in front of my face. But it's beautiful. It's got this lovely kind of pale, lemony, primrosy colour.
Wow.
Lovely blue foil, like little birds in the sky, a sort of a seascape. It's a Richard and Judy book club pick in 2011.
That's why it has that cover, because originally it had a much, much scarier cover. And then it got Richard and Judy book club and they put a much, dare I say it, more friendly cover on the front.
A blood-curdling ghost story.
It really is, and it is true. And how a tree stump can be as scary as it is. But it's about a bunch of Arctic explorers who go up to do some sort of scientific research, I believe it is. And the trip is fraught with peril. And one by one, they have to leave until one man is left in this cabin by himself and starts to think there is a reason why none of the fishermen will come to this remote Norwegian island. And he thinks he might not be alone. It's really scary. Ooh. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
And this is the scariest book.
The scariest book I have personally read. Yeah.
I see you've got a lot of Patrick Ness books. I really love those covers.
Well, I'm super good friends with Patrick Ness. So, and I think Patrick is among the best writers for young adults. He never patronises young adults. He doesn't talk down to them. He speaks and writes to them on their level. And he's got that thing where it's... Because I grew up very much on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I think that Patrick does that thing that Joss Whedon did with Buffy, which is he explores the horrors of being a teenager through metaphorical horrors, be it monsters or... you know, and Patrick's book always has an element of the dystopic or the dystopian and or the speculative, maybe perhaps more. I mean, if listeners haven't read the Chaos Walking trilogy, I would urge them to do so before the film comes out next year. It's going to be good.
If you were to go back to school and someone said, OK, you've got to teach a class this summer and you have to teach them one book, what would it be?
Oh, from YA, of YA.
Yeah, well, it could be anything you like. I don't know how old these imaginary children are. Maybe they're sort of year six-ish. Did you always teach year six, or did you?
Yeah, I mostly taught year six, so I did four. I did 7 years in school, four of which were in year six. Do you know, probably, you see, that's really difficult because we've now come to the P for Pullman section as well. Yeah, I will do Northern Lights by Philip Pullman. I think because Noughts and Crosses would be a very close second. So it'd be one of those. I mean, because I used to do both. I mean, that was the difference. But yeah, I think...
I'll let you have two. I'm a very generous headmistress.
Thank you. So yeah, there'd be Noughts and Crosses in there. There would be Northern Lights by Philip Pullman. You know, I think The Knife of Never Letting Go by Patrick Ness is phenomenal. I think, obviously, Monster Calls would be a great shout as well. I'm just looking at it right now, there's Only Ever Yours by Louise O'Neill. Really, really wonderful, wonderful stuff coming out of YA fiction.
I really love that idea that there's, you know, there are ways of exploring a really extreme time and externalising those horrors. I think that's a fascinating way of approaching it.
That list I've just reeled off, that could be a list of horror novels. You know, none of them were published as horror novels, but, you know, Northern Lights, looking at the dangers of dogmatic religion, and, you know, the idea that you could have your soul severed by the church is terrifying. And what I love about YA is that sometimes we fly under the radar as well. Like, had his Dark Materials been published as adult fiction, I think possibly they would have been flagged as blasphemy in a way that they won't. You know, Only Ever Yours is a book about feminism. Mm. Noughts and Crosses is a book about race. And I really like that I'm part of a type of literature where we can tackle really, really big ideas. And obviously, like, my last one tackled addiction, the new one tackles fame. So it's, I like that I can tackle those things, but in quite a safe environment. For me, what YA does quite well is, you know, we're not finger wagging or preaching about these big issues, but we're more saying, well, why don't we all talk about them together? Like, actually, that's not fair. I haven't had any flack for Clean. Sometimes I see people saying, oh, it's for older readers. But I think young people should be talking about addiction and mental health. You know, I think...
Wait until it comes up.
Don't wait until you're on heroin before you talk about heroin. I think that's terrible.
I should find out more about this. But what I love so much about... There's so much I love about Meat Market is that you've got, as well as the issues of consent and, you know, abuse, and but you've also got very... very happy consensual sex. You've got sex that sort of is, you know, fine at the time and then regrettably, all the different kinds of sex, obviously, but it's just so lovely, and it's something that I wish I'd had a lot more of when I was a younger reader, was just like, people have sex and it's basically fine and nobody dies of it.
Well, that was, I'm glad you've picked up on that, because that was something that was conscious. I knew when I started the book it would look at abuse within the fashion industry. But then I thought, well, no, actually, don't make sex the enemy. And I think sometimes YA has been guilty of making sex the enemy. And it's very much a slightly older trope that if a girl did have sex, she would get pregnant or someone would die.
And I think this idea as well that Jana in that book can absolutely be someone who has been abused, and she's a victim of a bad man, but not like, oh, but, you know, she was a virgin and she was pure before, you know, that's not, that doesn't ever come into question. I think that's really powerful and really important.
And as well, it did come from, and the previous novel, Clean, Lexi had a relationship with a guy called Brady that was quite problematic. And knowing everything that I learned about addiction and recovery, it wasn't a good idea for those characters to have a relationship while they were in a rehab facility. It was a dreadful idea. And then I started to sort of think, well, hang on a minute. We keep telling, I always assume my readers are girls and women. You know, if we constantly present these toxic relationships, where are we to learn the good ones?
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of do like a role model within the character. Yana's boyfriend is called Ferdy. And with Ferdy, I wanted to... Thank you. I love Ferdy as well. Just say, this is what a good boyfriend looks like. And I know there was questions about, you know, should he turn out to be secretly evil? And I was like, no. Because actually in real life, men by and large don't turn out to be evil. And there's a couple, I won't say because of spoilers, but there's another character in Meat Market who... I know both my agent and my editor thought would turn out to be a villain. And I was like, no, he's just a nice guy. He's not a shit. Yeah. Yeah. So, and it was interesting to me that they assumed he was going to go evil. And yes, a lot of men do go evil, but not all of them.
And also really great because, you know, as you said, you know,
would imagine that maybe a lot of your readers are girls and women, but when, you know, boys and men pick it up and, you know, they get absorbed and they're like, well, this is a nice role model for me. That's what you should do.
Ferdy's a good guy, you know, and I think it's interesting that, you know, while I was writing this book, I met my boyfriend who is very much a Ferdy. You know, he works in IT, he's a nerd, and yeah, he's just... He speaks that language of the internet. He knows feminism.
Cosmic ordering. You wrote A Perfect Boyfriend,
and then he appeared. Dreamed him into being. Yeah, random, but strange, but true.
I think it's all part of big magic. Into that. I keep saying things I want to ask you about. I'm going to go way down because it's one of my favourite books and I do talk about it too much. But very excited to see your copy of Valley of the Dolls, which I think I have this exact.
The pill one.
Is this the Julie Burchill forward? The Virago.
Mm-hmm.
When did you read Valley of the Dolls first?
Oh, a while ago now. It was, again, after I'd moved to Brighton. Someone somewhere has my very beautiful hardback. That sort of flock. I had a flock cover one. I have no idea where it is. Really beautiful ones. And it's gone. And so I sort of got in a strop. And maybe about 10 years ago now, I sort of vowed I wanted to start reading books that I'd always pretended I'd read. So like one of those was Handmaid's Tale, actually. I'd read other Atwood, but I'd never read Handmaid's Tale. So Valley of the Dolls was in that group of books that when people talked about Valley of the Dolls, I nodded along like I knew what they were talking about. But then I actually sat down and read it. And obviously it's very of its time, but I do love it. And it's kind of like a lot of ensemble pieces. It's not really about the main character. It's all about the Neely character, who is so much better. The one who does become the pill-popping nightmare.
But what I love the way... there's just so much I love about it. And I do think it was ahead of its time. Mm. And having women who are incredibly flawed and women who are kind of openly supportive but also jealous and competitive and messed up and very, I think those relationships between them are sort of authentic in the way they're ultra supportive but ultra not.
Yes. They don't spend a lot of time.
I'm never ever really interested in anything they're doing with men. I just want more good chats and more wig flushing would be nice.
And as well, you can see how a book like Valley of the Dolls, you know when they were developing Sex and the City at HBO, mm-hmm. Valley of the Dolls must have come up. That notion that, you know, the different kinds of famous, a writer, a publicist, an art gallerist, you know.
That fabulous sort of Jackie Collins thing as well, mm. of glamour that is written in a way that's very, very accessible. You know, the glamour never, ever tries to be authentic. It's like, it's a child's rendering of glamour. Like, you're in the big pink limousine that's 17 miles long and you're like, I opened my wallet and there was $10,000 in there. And
wearing a fur, always wearing a fur.
And obviously, Jacqueline Suzanne, I think, lived in a world of very authentic glamour that she didn't have, you know, she could have written about what she'd known and it would have been a lot more real and probably a lot less entertaining. I think a lot about something Lucy Mangan wrote in her book about books about ponies for girls, all of them written for girls who would love to have a pony and not at all for girls who had them, because like they were out with the ponies, they weren't
not
reading
to read, yeah.
If anyone who really knew about horse, they'd be like, well, that's not how it works, and that's not how you use a bridle, but it's a horse book, but for those of us who'd rather have a big pink limousine.
What else is there? Oh, I love that one. It's hilarious. I found that in a charity shop. It doesn't have words, just spooky pictures. I think it's Dutch.
A story to tell. It looks a bit like Dick Brother. He's not the Miffy man,
I think
Miffy,
yeah.
Because these look very...
I love these. I once got my year sixes to write the words.
Oh, that's such a great idea.
And they were just... they were so filthy. And these children were year sixes. But you can see that if you take them very literally, this is quite a dark book.
A sleeping orange child, a cockerel.
A cockerel wakes him up.
He's awake.
He has a wash in his pyjamas and brushes his teeth.
That's very much it's like, you know, in PE when you don't want to go in the shower, so you just like get your towel wet. And he's like, I'm in my pyjamas, but I'm holding a wet sponge. So I've definitely had a wash. I don't know what that is.
I think he's set out his outfit for the day. Yeah.
In a chair.
Mm-hmm.
He's eating some toast.
Mm-hmm.
Walking along.
He's walking to the shops.
And I don't know why I'm assuming this is a boy, but he might, you know, they might not be a boy.
He's very stylish with his white shoes and white hat and
it's
matching
a bit
buttons.
Like it could be in a Jean-Luc Godard film.
Mm-hmm. But look, he sees some bunnies.
Bunnies have come. They're sort of behind him.
Now, this is where it gets really weird.
He comes upon a weeping clown? And we believe
we
that's a clown?
We went for wizard.
Ah.
Yeah, a small weeping wizard.
The opposite of a laughing gnome, yeah. A weeping wizard.
And now this is where the kids really had fun because they read it as just abducting a child. So at this point, the plot took a twist.
Because the who we assume to be this child in his white hat and blue suit has got the
wizard
with the weeping wizard under his arm. But now they're building with really, really big blocks that are much bigger than either
wizard,
character.
Yeah.
And now he's making food.
Yeah.
Or he's got a watering can, but let's assume it's food because they are sat there sharing a plate, empty plate between them.
It's quite strange. I think they're saying a prayer, I think.
And he had a tiny spoon for the wizard and a tiny napkin.
Then he makes him watch while he's in the shower. That's again what the kids pointed out, again, not me.
And now they're both brushing their teeth at the end of the day. And now they're sleeping together.
You can see why
Stockholm Syndrome.
You can see why the year sixes went to town on that one.
That is a really, really beautiful book, though. And I'm sure much more.
And that's a collection of the first story anthologies that I worked on, which was when I used to do one day a week in inner city London schools working on poetry with talented young writers. Yeah, that was, I mean, I used to live, I did it for 6 years. That was once a week I would go up to schools. I started in Lambeth and just going up and doing poetry workshops once a week and it was brilliant.
Once Upon a Lunch.
That's actually not one of my ones. That one's one of mine.
I like the name.
That one's mine.
Islands of the Mind.
Lifted by the Legs was one of mine.
So were you working with students?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so and once a week. Yeah, you sort of set activities for them.
Great.
They're so talented. It's interesting because I've got a big bugbear about the way poetry is taught. You know, when we have such amazing contemporary poets and yet we still rely on these very pale, male, stale poets. And, you know, I always used to get the class. You say, right, who here has written a poem from the perspective of a soldier in World War One? And every hand would go up. And they say, Hansby, if you've written a poem from the perspective of you. None of them have. And they're being told that their voice and that their world isn't as valid as some dead poet from 150 years ago. It's wild. Even when I started writing, I felt, oh, I haven't been to author college. You know, I haven't done this properly. And you assume that Philip Pullman and J.K. Rowling and Patrick Ness must have been to some author college. And of course,
like getting a Hogwarts letter.
And I never got my Hogwarts letter. I was from a council house in Bradford. I never got my Hogwarts letter. I'm still waiting on my Hogwarts letter. And I don't think I'm going to get one. It turns out, of course, you know, I just needed that push. And that you just need a little bit of sort of self-confidence and think, well, I'm sure my book is as good as anybody else's, kind of. And then off I went.
I know you said that it was reading Noughts and Crosses that made you think this is something that
was a big moment, yeah.
I want to do. What was it about that made you realise that you had?
So Noughts and Crosses started a bit of a YA spree, and I was becoming very aware that there was a lot of American YA arriving on the scene, and of course that was on the back of Twilight. I mean, actually, I quite enjoy Twilight One. I think there's some merit to it. I think, you know, Bella is a really, really mangy teenager in a very believable way. And I think a lot of editors would have said, could you, you know, cheer her up a bit? But actually, she was believably sour. I mean, obviously, beyond that, they went absolutely insane. But the first one I think is great. And so I started borrowing the books from the kids in my class. And I knew very soon after Noughts and Crosses, you know, if I was going to write a novel, I think it would be before this audience. And so I kept on reading, and I read Noughts and Crosses and Hunger Games and various other pieces of post-Twilight supernatural stuff. But it was starting to strike me that they weren't massively diverse. Now, I think this was probably because at the time I was just reading those big ones. Mm. I've said to readers, look, if you just keep reading Harry Potter, don't be surprised when you only read the same characters. You know, like, but I've just read it so many times and they're still all white. And so I don't understand. And so I sort of said, well, okay, what did you love when you were a teenager? You loved sort of high school films and The Craft and Cruel Intentions and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But you weren't American. You went to school in Yorkshire. What if you and your mates were witches? And I think all good books start with a what if. And so I sat down. At the time, my partner was a pilot, and so he was away a lot of the time. And so while I was bored, kind of, and to stop myself cheating, I was very young, and I said, "Well, let's write this book." And it was kind of like The Craft meets Twin Peaks, and in a very fluky, and a lot of it is timing and luck. Hollow Pike, that was the book that became Hollow Pike, and it did get published, and that was, I think. So I started writing Hollow Pike in 2008. So it is a little over 10 years. If I'd have left it very much later, it wouldn't have sold, because already The Hunger Games was massively taking off. It was just before the first film came out, and all publishers wanted was Hunger Games-esque in a world where music is forbidden but dancing is mandatory. Those kind of stories. And so Hollow Pike got its book deal. It was a huge flop. I mean, actually, look, I've reread Hollow Pike recently because we've just sold the rights to the TV show, because, as is these things, witchcraft is massively coming back around in quite a big way with Sabrina and everything. So we've just sold the rights to Hollow Pike. And so I was rereading it, and it's fun.
Like, again, with notes and crosses, isn't it? You know, it's of its moment, and then for whatever reason, it's not, and then it comes back around. I find that hugely, hugely comforting.
Well, covens of witches are a great way to explore female friendship. Mm. And I think, you know, books about feminism and young women are so hot right now. And so I think it doesn't massively surprise me that witches are back on the agenda. So where did we get to? We're nearly at Z now. We're running out of books.
What's the Z-iest of...
It'll be Mark Zuzak, I suppose. It's probably on quite a lot of shelves. Has everyone you've been to had a copy of The Secret History by Donna Tartt? Is that literally on everybody's bookshelf?
It is on quite a lot. Do you love it?
Predictably, yes.
Oh, good.
And I want to not, because it's a bit of a hipster cliche, isn't it? And what's your favourite book? Let me guess. But it works. And what I love about Secret History is that every character in that book should be an insufferable dickhead, but actually you love them. And that, there must be some sort of magic there. And that was something that I tried to do with Clean in particular, was I created a character who is loathsome and sort of said, but do you understand why she's loathsome and can you learn to love her? And I think when you look at these fantastically privileged sort of characters, I love ridiculous nonsense like Cruel Intentions as well and Gossip Girl. So this is a hill I will die on. I think Secret History could be classed as a YA novel. It's about university students.
Because I truly, truly loved it. And I feel like I came to it quite late. I was definitely in my 20s when I read it. I think I was a bit daunted by it because it's this sort of really big book with this big black cover. And that's a lot. And I think I loved that world of, I love an obnoxious, elite, preppy universe. And I love it so much more, which I have a love-hate relationship with Bret Easton Ellis. But have you read The Rules of Attraction?
Of Attraction? And Lesson Zero, yeah.
But again, that sense that that's the same time in that universe. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and every so often, it's like the door is being opened upon a party and you see the Rules of Attraction basic bitches screeching and screaming through the little cracks in The Secret History and vice versa. Have you read Prep by Curtis Sittenfeld?
No.
I think you'd love it. Again, it's that, oh my God, it's so good. And there's a review that was really mean about it, where it's like, but someone said, well, nothing really happens. I'm like, exactly. Yeah. That's my kind of book. But she goes, it's about a woman, she gets into her head that she wants to go to a private school and sort of gets a scholarship, and like no one in her family is expecting her to, because she's kind of academically quite average. And I'm like, oh, I guess we better send you here. And she sort of, it's not bad, but it's not good. And she spends just a lot of time wondering why she's there. But it's so lovely and so teenagery, because she's not kind of, you know, rolling around going, oh, this is a big, terrible disaster. It's just that feeling really nothing and feeling very much like your life is all sort of periphery.
My new one, the new one that I'll be working on for the rest of this year, that's deals with some of those issues around privilege and... I shall say no more. All for later.
Would that be interesting and useful to read Curtis Sittenfeld, or would that be distracting?
It might. I mean, it's another YA, so if that one isn't... But I'm a big, big fan of books like Secret History, like Flowers in the Attic, which aren't officially sold as YA, but I think there's a real... argument there. But then weirdly argument.
I think Prep is absolutely there, because I'm pretty sure it was sort of marketed as adult fiction, but it is book. I think it's super
quite right. And I must admit, I've heard that's because I've come the other way, and I don't sense any snobbery around YA. I'm very proud to be a YA author, but I had people saying, and it's even come up with Clean at the Moment's on the prize for the YA book prize.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And people saying, oh, is this even YA? And I was like, yes, I think it is YA. because the characters are a little bit older and Lexi's a heroin addict. But I'm like, yeah, she's 17 and it's published by a YA list. So it's definitely YA, but it just deals with some very adult issues.
But I wonder whether there's that, because people are snobbish. They're like, well, I like this. And it's like, you know, with Harry Potter's in adult covers. I get the impression from what you said that the YA writing community is, it sounds like, an especially friendly and supportive one. It sounds like you've got some...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
crackers in your gang.
I think we're all a little bit worried. The industry is definitely, I don't want to say turning its back on YA, but it's lost a lot of faith and a lot of confidence in YA. I think we haven't had a big smash, certainly not in the last 18 months since The Hate U Give came out, Angie Thomas's one, and that sold really phenomenally well. The Lie Tree by Frances Harding sold really well. And before that, obviously The Fault in Our Stars, which was actually published on an adult list, but is very much a YA novel. And so I think, yeah, there, at the moment there's a little bit of reticence about YA. I would love them, however, when they're looking at these figures, to include Handmaid's Tale, which is on the A-level set list. So how many 16 and 17-year-olds are reading Handmaid's Tale as young adults? And yet all those sales, and I think it was the best-selling book of 2018, that's not being included towards YA. So that frustrates me. Those of us who are left, and it's really depressing, but a lot of us who were debuts around the same time as me just aren't doing it anymore. You know, they're either writing adult novels or have slightly gone back to other lines of work. But those of us who are still writing UK YAs, so Holly Bourne and Non Pratt, Kim Curran, Tanya Byrne, we're all still very close, and we move around the country together for Edinburgh Festival and Hay Festival and YALC, and we all see each other year on year, and there's a lot of, I think, a lot of shared love and respect there, because our work is so often looked down on, even though, you know, Clean has sold 30,000 copies.
That's
a lot more than a lot of literary novels. So, yeah, so it's kind of, people are reading it, and it's adults, and yet there is still this snobbery. And so I think, you know, when we get together, you know, we can take comfort in the fact that our books often sell very, very well. And I've been particularly lucky in that both Clean and Meat Market have received a huge level of reviewing and attention from the mainstream media in a way that most YA doesn't get that.
Huge thanks to Gino. Follow her and share your love at Gino Dawson on Twitter and Instagram. Meat Market is published by Quercus, and it's riveting, powerful and uplifting. I'd thoroughly recommend it. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, Biblio Bibuli. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time. For now, I leave you with an observation from Pat Conroy in The Prince of Tides. People that like to read are always a little fucked up.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.